My first personal experience with mind, body, and immunity, which has come to be known as psychoneuroimmunology, I think occurred when I was 11 years old. My parents decided that it was time for me to go away to summer camp. And although it wasn't really my first choice, I agreed to do this. And I went up to this YMCA facility in Wisconsin. And within about probably 12 hours, I decided that this was not the place for me. I really didn't particularly like the idea that someone was bugling me awake at 6 o'clock in the morning. I wasn't terribly fond of running about 3 miles and then jumping into this freezing cold Lake Chippewa. This young chap who was in the bunk on top of my bed had this funny propensity to have to go to the bathroom about 20 times during the night, always managing to step on my hand or my head as he was climbing off of his top bunk. So by the third night, I had made this decision in my mind that I was going to fake the worst cold and sore throat of my life and force my parents to come up from Chicago and take me home. I plotted this whole strategy and fell asleep, convinced that I'd be home by the next day. And to my total astonishment, when I woke up the next morning, I had this rip-roaring sore throat. My tonsils were swollen. I had about 103 temperature. And when I dragged myself to the infirmary, the nurse took one look at me, called my parents, and a few hours later, I was driving home in my dad's Chevy. And although I was totally miserable, I had this really clear idea in my mind, thinking, boy, this stuff really works. About 15 years ago, there was an article in the Bible of Western Medicine, which is the New England Journal of Medicine, which looked at the role of stress in people facing cancer. And although this study was very poorly designed, the author of this report came to the conclusion that stress had no role in the outcome of people with cancer. And therefore, they had put to rest once and for all the idea that the mind has any influence on our health. In fact, they called it folklore. The good news about that article is it really provoked a lot of backlash, and that scientists who really intuitively believed that there was some relationship between the mind and the body got excited to see what could be proven. And this has led over the past 20 years, but certainly most explosively over the past 10 years, to this burgeoning field of how the mind affects our physiology. And it's perhaps most clear in this whole realm of psychoneuroimmunology. Psyche is the Latin word for soul or mind. Neuro is the nervous system. Immunology is the understanding of how we defend ourselves from internal or external threats or challenges. And what we've really learned over the past 10 to 20 years is that there's this intimate relationship between the intelligence in our mind and the intelligence in our body. There's been an expansion of our understanding that every time we have an experience in the mind, it translates into some type of chemical or physiological change in the nervous system. So if I'm falling in love or falling out of love or watching a sunrise or listening to a Bach symphony or seeing my son come home with his report card grades, whatever the experience is, that is interpreted in my mind and then instantly transforms the chemistry of our brain. We first started defining these chemicals as neuropeptides or neuromessengers because we thought that they were primarily localized to the nervous system. But subsequently, we've learned that these same chemical messengers really are permeating our physiology and influencing every system in our body. So that same chemical that we create when we're feeling ecstatic about a job promotion, that chemical filters into our bloodstream, communicates that information to our heart, to our gut, to our immune system. Similarly, the immune system is continuously monitoring the internal and external environment and sending back messages to our brain. There's this constant dialogue, communication network between our minds, our brains, our endocrine system, which is the system that creates our hormones, and our immunological system. In fact, the expression that we like to use is that our immune cells are constantly eavesdropping on our internal dialogue. If you just close your eyes for a minute and listen, you'll immediately become aware that there's a voice that is carrying on a conversation with itself. I'm getting pretty hungry right now. Wonder how much longer he's going to talk. I should have gone to the bathroom at the break. I wonder how my kids are doing. I hope my husband remembered to take the chicken out of the freezer. Oh, I better pay attention right now. I'm paying good money for this. I wonder what they're doing with all that money. Conversation. Constant conversation. And in addition, there's a tone to it. There's a feeling to it. It's really more that feeling to it that's being communicated to every cell in the body. Now, when I first began to explore this and talk about this, particularly to medical audiences, I was a little bit shy about anthropomorphizing, making human these little conversations that take place. But then I read recently a beautiful book by Dr. Jonas Salk called Anatomy of Reality. Those of you, I'm sure, remember that Jonas was the creator of the Salk polio vaccine, which really saved millions of lives worldwide. And he was an amazing philosopher who lived here in La Jolla and died a few years ago. And he describes in this book how he would continuously assign personalities to the various systems that he was studying. So he would assign a personality to an immune cell, to a virus, to a cancer cell, and he would carry on these conversations, and those conversations would give him insights into experiments that he could then perform to understand the process in a deeper level. And so we can imagine the conversations that are going on between our minds and our immune cells. One conversation might be, I am so tired of this job. I am sick of my boss. He's a jerk. I can't wait to get out of here. My relationships are a total mess. I'm just not happy in my life. We send those signals to our immune cells. Our immune cells circulating around are saying, God, I'm really not liking my job very much either these days. I have been feeling kind of depressed about my work. There's a funny looking virus. Yeah, I'll let somebody else take care of it. I'm not getting paid enough for this anyways. On the other hand, we could imagine this other conversation. Boy, I have a great life right now. I have a wonderful person in my life who fulfills my needs. My kids are doing great. I'm really happy in my job. I'm enthusiastic about what I'm involved in. I even have a vacation to look forward to in 2 weeks. I'm doing great. Our immune cells are having the same conversation. I'm really in a great mood today. Look at that funny little cell. It looks like it's slightly transforming its genetic code. Uh-oh, we don't want any cancer here. I'll comfortably remind this chap that there's no room for him in this organization. So there's this continuous dialogue, and by making choices that improve the quality of this dialogue, we can improve the quality of our immunological functioning. It's a network, a two-way highway. When we recognize something in the environment as being potentially threatening, our immune cells immediately assess the situation, send back information to the nervous system. There's a continuous dialogue taking place through the process of these neural peptides, these little chemical messengers which are carrying tremendous amounts of information on the quality and quantity of our environment, both internally and externally. There are many close similarities between our brain, our nervous system, and our immune cells. The one thing that really characterizes the nervous system is the diversity of cells. There's a whole vast range of different cells. The immune system similarly has a vast array of diverse different cells which are continuously interacting with each other but have very specific assigned roles. Memory is an important characteristic of both our immune cells and of our nerve cells. We certainly understand that when we have an experience as a child, we remember that has a formative impact upon our lives later on. Similarly, our immune cells have memory. How they experienced viruses, bacteria, stress hormones early on is carried with them so that later on in life they can respond, hopefully, in an appropriate way. As Deepak mentioned, we carry the memory not only of our individual life, but of our entire evolution. So that if my immune cell never saw a tuberculosis bacteria before, it still carries in its cellular memory. It'll go back into its cellular memory until it identifies friend or foe, dangerous or nurturing. Both our nervous system and our immune system is really intimately involved in adaptation, defense, and homeostasis. We're constantly monitoring what's going on around us and adjusting ourselves to maintain inner balance. The immune cells are monitoring both what's going on the outside as well as the inside. Similarly, our nervous system is continuously monitoring the environment for potential challenges as well as internal signals. It allows us to respond to a potentially hostile environment. Immune cells are able to communicate with each other so that a T cell, and we'll talk about this in more detail in just a minute, actually can transmit little tiny packages of information to a B cell telling it, rev it up, we're going into battle. So let's talk about the basic players here. There are several characters in this cast which each have their own particular role but are continuously communicating and interacting with each other. The macrophage, which means big eater, macro big, phage eater, is one of the first cells on the scene when something enters our system that we determine shouldn't be there. So if this is a bacteria that could cause us pneumonia if it's not immediately eliminated, then the macrophage gobbles it up. And in its gobbling it up, it breaks it down, and it divides it into recognizable packages, which it then displays on its surface. So the macrophage might be the first policeman on the scene. And as soon as it arrives, it assesses the situation, and then the macrophage sends out a message saying, there's something potentially criminal going on here. I'm calling for troops. One of the first troops that arrives is a T cell. The T cell basically reads the information from the macrophage, and as soon as it identifies that something potentially harmful is in the system, it gets revved up and becomes an activated T cell. When it gets revved up, it starts producing more and more of the chemicals that are sending out the information to all the other cells in the immune system. One of the important cells that it sends that information out is a B cell. A B cell is a cell that creates antibodies. And antibodies are like little torpedoes or heat-seeking missiles that once it understands that there's something in the environment that could be potentially harmful, it releases and attaches to the foreign invader that needs to be eliminated. So the macrophage processes the invader, signals to the T cell that it's potentially harmful. The T cell gets revved up, sends these little chemical messengers to the B cell, and the B cell starts sending out these little missiles. And that's really how we fight off viruses, infection, cancer cells, and when it's functioning in a healthy way, it all takes place with us having to even know that it's happening. Now, one of the important cells in this process is called a natural killer cell, or an NK cell. This cell is like a T cell, but it actually connects directly or attaches directly to a bacteria or a cancer cell. And then while it's attached, it secretes these little tiny chemical packages which punch holes in whatever organism it is that we want to eliminate from our system. And as soon as you punch holes in the membrane of an organism, it loses its ability to reproduce. Natural killer cells are particularly important if there are cancer cells that are floating throughout the circulation. It's what protects us from cancer metastasizing to other parts of our body. And we'll be coming back to natural killer cells because it's one of the cells that responds the quickest and the earliest to any changes in our state of mind. Within a few minutes of being stressed, we're in an auto accident, we get a bad diagnosis from a doctor, we come home and we find out that our husband or wife has left us. Within a few moments, actually, the natural killer cell starts to respond to that change in our environment. Now, there are dozens of different chemicals that carry the communication between the mind and the body. There are a number of these different chemicals that are continuously communicating between the mind, the brain, and the immune system. Ones that are commonly heard today are interferon. Interferon is, when it's secreted from a cell, it actually enhances the ability for these macrophages to let the rest of the system know that there's something foreign here that needs to be addressed. Interleukins are other types of chemicals which cause the white blood cells to differentiate and become more active in fighting off infection. Tumor necrosis factor is one of the chemicals that the natural killer cell releases when it wants to punch holes in the foreign invader. So there are a number of these different chemicals which are interesting because they're the codes that nature uses to communicate information within the nervous system, within the endocrine system, and within the immune system. Now, this understanding of how the mind communicates to the body has really been going through an evolution since the 1930s. One of the first encounters I had with Walter B. Cannon, who was a great American physiologist, was actually when I was an anthropologist and studied a phenomenon known as voodoo death. It turns out in certain cultures in Africa, if a person violates a major taboo, for example, if you sleep with the king's wife, they don't lock you up in jail, they don't hang you, they have a ceremony for you declaring that you're dead. And at that point, no one acknowledges that you exist. Your family stops talking to you, your friends stop talking to you. In fact, they'll walk right by you and not even acknowledge your presence. And Dr. Cannon studied these people and found that almost invariably within 2 weeks, these otherwise healthy people died. And when he studied them, he found that during this period, they were in a very high state of stress and anxiety. Their heart rates were beating 120, 140 beats per minute. Their blood pressure was rising. They were pouring out tremendous amounts of stress hormones. And they basically died of this intense, unsustainable level of stress. He called this the stress response or the fight or flight response, and was really one of the first to teach that this was an adaptive response at one time of evolution, but becomes less adaptive at different stages. So that when we, maybe 25,000 years ago, were hiking through the jungle and suddenly a cobra slithers across our pathway, we would instantly activate the fight or flight response. Our heart would start beating faster. We would start breathing deeper and taking in more oxygen. Our pupils would dilate to let in more light. Our lunch would no longer be receiving blood supply because the blood would be going to the muscles of our arms and our legs. Our sweat glands would start to perspire to cool off our body. Our minds would become hyper alert. And our adrenal glands would be pumping out adrenaline and noradrenaline and cortisol to rev our system up to deal with a very stressful situation. So this is the fight or flight response. It was very adaptive when we were in a predatory environment. We don't have as effective claws and teeth that a lot of the predators had, so we had to develop this response, which confronting that python or that saber-toothed cat, we would either run as quickly as we could to get out of that situation or pick up the nearest stick and fight, depending upon whether or not we thought we could win or not. The problem is that this is one of the most deeply wired survival mechanisms that we have, and we continue to activate this fight-or-flight response many times throughout our day and throughout our life. So that if I'm driving to give a lecture, I'm going a little bit over the speed limit, and suddenly in my rearview mirror I see the flashing lights of the California Highway Patrol, I instantly activate my fight-or-flight response. My heart starts beating faster, I start sweating, my pupils dilate, my stomach goes into a cramp because I'm taking all the blood supply away. But what do? I usually don't run, and I usually don't fight. I pull over to the side of the road, put this big smile on my face. Oh, I'm sorry, officer. You know, I just got this call that the chief of police mother is there with a little stroke. I was trying to get there as fast as I could. We suppress that experience. And we do it a lot. And we do it many times throughout the day. You're standing in the under 10 checkout line and the guy in front of you has 12 items in their basket. Your son brings you home his D on his algebra test. Somebody cuts you off on the highway. You have to wait on hold interminably when you're calling to schedule your reservation for a seminar. All these little stresses cause these little twinges of the fight or flight response. And the accumulation of these inappropriately activated stress responses probably have a lot to do with the wear and tear on our physiology, which are responsible for many of the common illnesses that we're facing today. So high blood pressure, heart disease, insomnia, anxiety, depression. These are all reflections of exhaustion of the system due to this continuous, frequent activation of the stress response. The second stage of this understanding of mind-body interactions really was developed by a great Canadian endocrinologist named Hans Selye. Hans Selye brought in the understanding that not only does the nervous system contribute to activation when we're facing a challenging event in our lives, but also our endocrine system, that our hormones are intimately involved in the process of how we regulate homeostasis, balance in our lives. When I was a freshman medical student at the University of Chicago, I was already considered a little bit marginal because I was teaching meditation to my classmates. And to try to gain some level of credibility, I actually arranged for Dr. Selye to come to do grand rounds at Billings Hospital, because he was really one of the major researchers on the role of stress on physiology. And so I had this entire auditorium packed with about 400 faculty and students at the University of Chicago, including probably about six Nobel Prize winners in the audience. And it was scheduled to start at noon, and Dr. Selye was nowhere to be found. So I was beginning to have my own stress response. I ran to the nearest phone, called his office in Montreal, and said, "Where's Dr. Selye?" And his assistant informed me that as far as she knew, he was on his had arrived in Chicago the evening before. So I was walking back to this auditorium with visions of Dr. Selye having been kidnapped or trying to change a tire on the side of the road, and was making in my mind my apologies to the entire university staff, certain now that I would never be accepted again. When I walked into the room, and there was Dr. Selye up there speaking, he had come in another door as I was walking out the auditorium. No one was even there to introduce him, so he just started talking. And as I sat down, he was describing the physiological changes that occur with a stress response. I thought, there's a great experiential not understanding. And then the final component, or the most recent component of this understanding, has really been this recognition that there is a direct linkage between the nervous system and our immune system. So we can affect our immune system through our nervous system, particularly our sympathetic or stress nervous system. We can affect our nervous system through our endocrine system, through our hormones. And there are actually really fascinating pictures now of the nervous system directly encasing immune cells in our spleen, in our thymus, in the bone marrow, so that almost instantly when we have a stress response, the immune cells are revved up, almost as if it's a car at the Indianapolis 500 where you have those gasoline lines hooked up to the car ready to go as soon as the information has been transmitted. And the information is continuously feeding back into the nervous system as well. We have a stress in the mind. The brain communicates that stress to a deep center called the hypothalamus. Hypothalamus is really the conductor of our responses. It has influences directly on the pituitary gland, which controls the hormonal system, and it has direct input into the sympathetic nervous system, which controls our stress responses. So we interpret an experience, we communicate that experience to the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus then communicates that to the pituitary gland, to the nervous system. Pituitary gland then may cause the adrenal gland to release cortisol. The nervous system may cause the inner part of the adrenal gland to release adrenaline. Both of these chemicals have a direct effect on our immune cells. And then the immune cells feed back the information. It's amazing how quickly this communication network occurs. It's been shown now that if you give your child an immunization to, say, chickenpox, within about 6 minutes, you can see changes in the brain of that child, even before you can see any type of changes in the blood. As soon as there's a change in the environment, information is transmitted quickly to the brain, which brings its attention to begin to organize the appropriate response. One of the chemicals that acts is called interleukin-1. There's actually now about 15 of these interleukins. Inter means between, leukon means blood cells, or white blood cells. So these interleukins are these chemicals that these white blood cells or these lymphocytes make to communicate both to each other and back to the brain. And so to complete the network, not only does the brain communicate by way of the hypothalamus to the pituitary gland, to the sympathetic nervous system, to our immune cell, but the immune cell is feeding back information continuously to the nervous system. It's an ongoing conversation. So that's the basic science. Let's talk a little bit about how it applies to real life. Although it took a while for people to pay attention, one of the earliest and most fascinating studies was done by Dr. Robert Ader at Ohio State University. He was trying to do a Pavlovian study. So remember, Pavlov, a Russian scientist, showed that if you ring a bell every time you feed your dog, which causes them, of course, to salivate, pretty soon, just by ringing the bell, the dog will begin to salivate, even without introducing the food, because they've associated the sound of the bell with an experience. It's called the neuroassociative conditioned response. Neuroassociative conditioned response. And we'll be using that a lot throughout this course to teach you how to create the best possible associations. What Robert Ader wanted to do is to see if he could create a similar response between a taste and an experience. So what he did was take some rats. He put an intravenous line into a vein in their tail. He then brought into their cages some water that was sweetened with saccharin. And as soon as the rat tasted the saccharin with its tongue, he injected a very strong chemical called cyclophosphamide, or cytoxin. It's a medicine that we use today as a chemotherapy drug used in a number of other immune disorders. And it has, as a very prompt side effect, severe nausea and vomiting. So as soon as the rat's tongue hit the sweet water, he injected this dose of this medication, which instantly caused the rat to become overwhelmingly nauseated and to vomit. Delightful, huh? Okay. Then he followed these rats, and over the course of the next 10 days, the bone marrows and the lymph glands showed a suppression in activity, because this is a very powerful immune-suppressing drug. He waited until they recovered completely, taking several weeks. And then he repeated the experiment. This time, he put the same intravenous line into their vein. He exposed them to the same saccharin-sweetened water. But instead of injecting this powerful drug, he just injected some sugar water. As soon as the rat's tongue touched the saccharin, they became nauseated and vomited, because it was such a strong memory from the previous experience that without any further intervention, they got sick, the same way that ringing the bell caused the dog to salivate. That was expected. But what was unexpected is that if you followed their immune system for the next 7 to 10 days, they showed the same level of suppression as if they had gotten this potent drug. Just the interpretation of this experience had a profound and measurable change on their physical state. Do you see how amazing this study was? It's really the first time that someone had scientifically shown that just an interpretation in the mind could have a profound effect that could affect the well-being of an animal. And from that, there were a whole host of fascinating studies looking at how this might apply to human beings. Many scientists searched for models of behavior that were under stress. And a great model for that is being a medical student. Another great thing about medical students is that they're very willing subjects, because they have this thing about authority. And so medical students have been a great model for stress, and several studies have looked at what happens to medical students under times of stress. If a medical student was not well prepared for a final anatomy examination, you could measure their immune function and show that it was suppressed. If they were very well prepared, it was suppressed, but not to the same degree. If after the anatomy exam they thought they did very well on it, their immune system showed recovery. And if a week later they got their final back and they passed, then their immune system showed a full recovery. So in this very real life situation, we could show that stress can have a direct and very rapid effect on our ability to fight off infection. Exactly 10 years after that study came out that reported that the mind had no influence on the body in people with cancer, this study by Cohn was published in the same journal, the New England Journal of Medicine, which demonstrated that our perceptions of our life actually have a very direct and profound experience on how we respond to challenges. In this study, he had people rate their life for the past 30 days on a stress scale. So, had you lost your job in the last 30 days? How was your marriage? Have you been sleeping very well? How's your digestion? How's your financial situation? And came up with a scale. He then had everyone in this study sniff up a little bit of cold virus, rhinovirus, which is the virus that most commonly causes an upper respiratory infection. And then he monitored how many of these people and to what degree they got the symptoms of a full-blown cold or flu. And he found that there was a very direct correlation between how stressful your previous month was and whether or not you were likely to experience a full-blown episode of a cold. If you were very stressed, almost certainly you were going to come down with the infection. If you had very little stress in your life over the past month, you could still find the viruses in your nasal passages, but you didn't come up with a full-blown sneezing and coughing and sickness. And so again, a very direct and very practical understanding of how our states of mind influence our susceptibility to illness. A common chronic stressful situation is taking care of a family member that has a chronic disease. And Alzheimer's disease is one of those illnesses which is extremely stressful on people. And studies on the caregivers to spouses with Alzheimer's have shown that their immune function is substantially impaired. Probably all of us have seen situations where we have a designated patient. You know, Mr. Jones has Alzheimer's disease or has cancer. And all the attention is focused on Mr. Jones. And then suddenly Mrs. Jones comes down with a serious illness as well, because the wear and tear of caring for a loved one is causing a deterioration in their own immune function. And there's measurable changes in the immune system to document that. Believe it or not, there's such a thing as the UCLA loneliness scale. I was thinking about this recently because there's just a story on National Public Radio that psychologists are now studying homesickness in kids that go away to camp. So I figured it must be that I was particularly homesick and lonely, which is why I was able to get my cold, because my natural killer cell activity was suppressed. In any group of people, college students away for the first time, med students, people stuck in psychiatric hospitals, people moving to new cities who haven't been able to make friends, loneliness is a good predictor of susceptibility to illness. And the higher you score on these scales of loneliness, the more likely you are to come down with some type of usually infectious illness, a cold, a flu, mono. And it seems to be primarily because of this very quick response of the natural killer cells. These cells are like nerve cells. They're constantly hearing what's going on and change very rapidly. I was just at a meeting of the American Psychiatric Association with Dr. George Solomon, who's really the father of psychoneuroimmunology, and he was quoting a study that if you just take a person and wake them up at 3 o'clock in the morning and keep them up for the rest of that day, that within an hour you will see changes in the natural killer cells, that they will be less effective in fighting off infection, and that they'll recover. If the next night they're able to get a full night of sleep, by the next morning they'll have recovered again. That quickly. So we can just imagine how someone's under stress. They're not sure they're going to get their business proposal in on time. They're worried about they're losing their job. Their relationship with their boyfriend is breaking up. They're not sleeping that well that night. Very instantly, you're going to see that your susceptibility to illness becomes less. So we'll talk about sensory modulation. Another rapid change is you can quickly increase or decrease natural killer cell activity by touching someone lovingly. If you deprive someone of touch for a period of several days, their natural killer cells will begin to function less optimally. You can correct that very rapidly with a 15-minute massage. One of the things that's been looked at is how common illnesses are in the elderly population. And we actually had a discussion at this meeting how maybe the reduction in immune function in our senior population is really a tactile deficiency syndrome, that our elderly population is not being touched enough. And so the connections are very quick and very rapid and really give us a lot of confidence in some of the mind-body approaches that we'll be reviewing this week. Most studies have shown that loss of a spouse is one of the most stressful events that you can experience. And it's quite clear that there's an abrupt shift in the immune function at the time that the spouse dies. So you may be taking care of your husband or your wife or your mom or your dad, and there's clearly some stresses on the system, and your immune system will reflect that. But when there's the death, there's abrupt deterioration in that function. And it seems to correlate with the depth of depression and grieving. So that people who can get back on with their lives after an appropriate period of grief will show a recovery of their immune function. But people who years later are still really not over it, are still in that state of depression and loss and hopelessness, will be increasingly susceptible to illness as time goes by. In fact, large studies have shown, the largest one was the Western Electric Health Study, which looked at really thousands of people, have shown that for 15 years after death of a spouse, there is an increased risk of developing heart disease, cancer, infectious diseases. So it's really something that can have a lasting effect if we don't take action to try to reestablish balance. How could we explain the possibility of someone getting cancer a year after someone close to them died? It goes back to the same model. Stress, which we experience in our mind, it's an interpretation. It causes changes in our nervous system, changes in our hormonal structure, changes in the hormones that influence our immune cells. Immune cells get lazy. The cancer cell arises. We experience about 10,000 potentially mutating hits to our genetic code every day through free radical formation from toxins in the environment, foods that we eat, cigarette smoke. And so our ability to survive without serious illness is very much dependent upon our immune cells promptly recognizing, promptly sending out the message, and promptly repairing the damage to our cells. If we're under a state of chronic stress, our minds are sending out these negative messages, our immune cells are not capable of responding promptly. It makes us very susceptible to the chaos, to the deterioration of the stress in our environment. If death wasn't bad enough, divorce seems to be worse. It's particularly distressing considering that about half of the marriages in the Western world are ending in this divorce. In fact, most studies have shown that divorce may have a more substantial impact on immunological function than death. But in both men and women, you can show impairment in immune function lasting for months to years after divorce. Okay, is everybody sufficiently depressed right now? The good news is that we can substantially offset and impact these changes from stress. We deeply believe that taking time every day to go into silence is probably the most health-promoting, health-enhancing activity that human beings can do. And there have now been hundreds of studies on the health-promoting effects of meditation. You can simply take people in a nursing home, teach them a simple breathing awareness meditation, which we'll learn after lunch, and instantly, meaning within a day, show improvement in their immunological functioning. You can teach men who are infected with the AIDS virus, with HIV, some simple relaxation techniques, ways of asserting their emotions in a healthy way, and you can show improvements in their immunological functioning and a delay in the time for the expression of AIDS. Dr. David Spiegel, psychiatrist at Stanford, has been quoted widely now, showing that just simply getting people together to express their feelings in an environment that supports them and that gives them tools to access deeper, more comfortable levels of their being can improve quality and quantity of life. He looked at a group of women with metastatic breast cancer. And he had them come weekly to a support group meeting in which they were taught relaxation techniques as well as given opportunities to express their emotional feelings. And he expected that they would improve somewhat in their quality of life. And they did. They showed that women who participated had less need for pain medication, less need for sleeping medication, generally rated themselves as having more energy in their lives. But what he didn't expect, in fact, he even sought to prove the opposite, was that these women actually had a doubling of their survival time. Now, if Roche Pharmaceutical came out with a medication that we gave to women with stage 4 breast cancer that doubled their survival time, every oncologist in the world would be bombarded by drug representatives, and it would probably be considered malpractice if it wasn't prescribed. And yet, this very simple cost-effective modality of supplying a support group to patients with breast cancer is still not standard of practice almost anywhere in the United States. Most of these groups are really lay groups that are not directly supported by the healthcare systems. We've got to change that mode. A simple intervention, which is very effective and we use really almost universally now at the Chopra Center, is writing about what's upsetting you. It turns out that if you take college students who are feeling somewhat lonely and you instruct them that at the end of every day, just write a little bit in their diary or their journal about what went wrong during the day, and you compare that to another group that didn't, the group that did has much fewer visits to the campus healthcare clinic, much fewer incidents of illness. It's a way of expressing yourself, releasing the emotional toxicity, and has a direct effect on enhancing immune function. Now, this is true not only for human beings, but for all animals, at least all sentient animals. Japan has really been very interested over the last few years in the therapeutic value of aromatherapy, and we'll be talking more about it during this course. Shibata did an interesting study. It's unfortunate how many different ways we've learned to stress our beloved animal creatures. And so, I'll tell you quite honestly, I wish that we could do these studies without having to use animal models. But since these studies were done, I think it's very useful to use the information and try to make good use of them. In Shibata's study, he took mice and he subjected them to a stress. The stress was the cage was actually electrified. And at random intervals, he would apply these electrical shocks to these poor little creatures. And he'd have them in these cages for a couple hours. And of course, at the end of this experience, they had high levels of stress hormones or immune function was depressed. Then he took them out of the cage and he put them into their safe cages. And in the safe cages, he had cedar wood shavings, which had that really pleasant fragrance to it. And that was the safe cage. And then a few days later, he repeated the study. Same type of stress was administered, but this time he had the cedar wood shavings all around the cage so that they could smell that. And he found that that alone substantially blunted the stress response. They didn't produce as much stress hormone. They didn't have the same suppression in their immune function because just the memory that was triggered of that safe environment by that smell had a calming, pacifying effect. It shows the power of association. If that smell was present during the initial stress, then it probably would have magnified it. So if he had exposed them to that smell while they were getting stressed and then still had that smell present when they were in their rest cages, they probably wouldn't have had the same recovery. So it's not just the aroma, but the association of the aroma that seems to have the most powerful influence. And we'll show you how we use that in therapeutic ways. Another important study was a study by Fauzi Fauzi. It's actually his first name and his last name. At UCLA, who looked at people with malignant melanoma, which is the most serious type of skin cancer. And he found that just by giving them an hour and a half of cognitive intervention, meaning that he taught them relaxation technique, he taught them how to express themselves, he found that not only did they have an improvement in this natural killer cell, but also they had a much longer survival curve. Very simple interventions that can be used easily in our practices for ourselves, for our family, for our patients and our clients, and really are the markers of this new paradigm of how to use consciousness to influence our health. It's a really useful model to look at our immune function as how we respond to the external world and how we respond to the internal world. What we're looking for is balance. It's a word that we'll talk a lot about, particularly as we go into more of the Ayurvedic concepts. Balance means the ability to have an appropriate response to the challenge that is at hand. It doesn't mean being so relaxed that when some burglar jumps into your house, you just offer him a cup of tea. It also means not being so aggressive that when you hear some noise on the front lawn, you come out with your shotgun. It means being able to use the best of intelligence and of consciousness to mount an appropriate response. To both internal and external challenges, we can mount the corrective response, an excessive response, or an inadequate response. And if we look at it this way, we can really understand a lot of the common illnesses. So, if we're mounting an excessive response to an external stimulus, we end up with an allergy. There's nothing inherently evil about a pollen from a rose that happens to land in our nasal passages. But if we interpret that as being potentially dangerous, if we mount an excessive response, then we have an allergy. But it's not that there's anything inherently harmful about the stimulus, it's just we've interpreted it in that way. So an excessive response to an external stimuli can give us an allergy. We also have the capability of mounting an excessive response to an internal stimulus. And when that happens, we get autoimmune diseases, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, systemic lupus erythematosus, mixed connective tissue diseases. We have a lot of these immune diseases, which seem to be a reflection of our immune cells have somehow identified something that we think should be normal, but the immune cells are identifying it as something foreign. So in multiple sclerosis, it looks at some of the insulation around a nerve cell, the myelin, and says, there's something fishy about this myelin. It makes me nervous. I think I'm going to start attacking it. And we mount an immune response where really it's adding no value. So excessive to the internal environment, autoimmune, excessive response to an external environment, allergies. Similarly, we can mount an inadequate response. If we're too sleepy, lethargic, lazy on the job, overwhelmed, then we're not going to be responding appropriately. So an immune cell sees a cold virus, a bacteria, and says, I'm really just too tired to get out of bed today. We end up getting the expressions of that infection. Similarly, if we have an immune response that's inadequate to an internal stimulus, then we can develop cancer. Continuously, right while we're sitting here, there are potential cancer-causing changes that are occurring in our genetic codes. But most of the time, between our DNA repair mechanisms and our immune function, we're able to quickly identify and stop that process before it goes into the next phase. But when the system is lazy, we're not able to mount that adequately. So what we're looking for is that perfect state of balance, that set point. The stress response takes us out into that aggressive mode. The restful alertness response takes us back to our set point. That's why we really so deeply believe that regular elicitation of that restful alertness response is really one of the most important keys to good health. So we're going to talk about technologies to access inner silence. Over the past 20 plus years, I think we've begun to recognize that the capability of having a quiet mind is something that can be valued and cherished and has real value in the world. For quite a while, we would envision people meditating as those people that would withdraw completely from the world, live in a cave in the Himalayas, and never create anything of value that we would measure with our usual material viewpoint. But increasingly, I think we're recognizing that taking time to go into quiet states of our own awareness actually generates more creativity and more success and more joy in life. Now, what is the value of meditation? It's really twofold. One is its value in its own right. It has no intention other than its own experience. Throughout our days, almost every single thing that we do because we anticipate a specific outcome. You know, I put on my pants because I expect to go out and take the dogs. I t- type a chapter because I expect to release a book. I go to the grocery store because I want to make a Caesar salad. We don't do anything just for its own sake. Perhaps making love. The value of meditation is that it's absolutely for its own sake. It's a way of going beyond the body, going beyond the mind, going beyond the emotions, and contacting that field of conscious awareness, spirit, that is self-sufficient in its own right. And the value of that is that it reconnects us with the aspect of ourselves, which is our true nature. Most of us are continuously identifying ourselves with situations, circumstances, objects in our environment. So, who are you? People usually start by saying, well, I'm a mother, I'm a father, I'm a chairman of a corporation, I'm a driver of a Corvette. We define ourselves in terms of the possessions and positions in our lives. And from an Ayurvedic perspective, that is an absolutely sure formula for suffering. Because anything that we can identify ourselves with that's outside of our nature, outside of our true being, is by definition a time-space event. As Deepak mentioned earlier, time-space event means it's localized in space and has a duration in time. If we can perceive it with our senses, be it a galaxy, a nebula, a star, a flower, a relationship, a bank account, a human body, it will be in this realm of time and space, meaning that it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. That's why everything in this universe can be described in terms of a wave. So if all we know in our lives are situations and circumstances and people and things that are time-space events, then at some deep level of our awareness, we will be always living in fear. Because we know that we're going to lose it at some point. You can have an absolutely fabulous marriage, and then in some way or another, it's going to be lost. Either it's going to end in divorce, it's going to end in one or the other of the spouses dying. You can have a great position in a corporation. Sometime or another, it's going to come to an end. You can have making hundreds of thousands of dollars in the stock market. You're very happy. The Dow's at new highs. Whatever level of enjoyment or happiness you're experiencing because of that success, when tomorrow, knock on wood, it doesn't happen, the stock market crashes, you'll have a proportionate level of sorrow. So this object referral in Ayurvedic understanding is the basis of all suffering. And the only solution, the only lasting solution, is self-referral, which means getting intimately in contact with that aspect of our own nature, which is beyond time and beyond space. And the most effective and direct way of accomplishing that is through meditation. Now, what happens in the process of meditation? As we mentioned earlier, the mind is a thought-generating machine. In fact, it's actually been suggested that the mind is only the thoughts that occupy it. If you take away the thoughts, you take away the mind. The mind is continuously generating thoughts, one thought after another. What am I going to say next? I hope I don't forget what I'm supposed to say. I wish I would have gone to the bathroom. I better call my wife at the next break. I told her I was going to come home for lunch. I wonder if my son stopped off at the house today. It's constant generation, almost 24 hours a day. It gets a little bit fuzzy when we're sleeping. So how do we get beyond the thoughts? We can only get beyond the thoughts by going through the spaces between the thoughts. In between each thought, snowing outside, I think I better shovel the walk. No, I'd rather go to Florida. I wonder if I can get a plane. I wonder if I have enough frequent flyer miles. There's always some gap there. We dive into that gap, we access the next impulse, it comes out as a thought, go back into that gap, access the next impulse, it comes out as a thought. Meditation techniques are all designed to do the same thing. That's to allow us to slip into the silent spaces between the thoughts. And that can happen by allowing ourselves to put our attention on some object that doesn't carry meaning. The meaning is what connects us to the next thought. One thought has meaning and a sound quality. The next thought has meaning and a sound quality. Every thought, every word has both a vibration and an attachment of a meaning to that vibration. We can interrupt that eternal cycle of thought leading to thought, leading to thought, leading to thought, by finding some object of attention that allows us to temporarily disconnect the meaning that keeps us in this association. In Ayurveda, sound is the subtlest experience. Sound is that vibration that stirs the silence. And so, using sound to transcend, to go beyond thinking, is said to be the most effective and most direct way to experience that deeper level of awareness. In fact, it's said that thinking is just a subtle form of hearing. And so in many traditions, we can use sound as an object of attention. We can use sound out loud. Let's do it together since we need a little energy. So we'll use these classical sounds, the sounds of the chakras. As most people are familiar in certain systems of Vedic knowledge, Tantra in particular, said that we have 7 basic energy centers. And each of those centers is associated with a color and a crystal and a gem and an energy and a sound. And by putting your attention on that energy center and vocalizing the vibration, you can enliven the energy in that area. So why don't we do it all together? I'll sit down. So the first energy center is at the base of the spine, the first chakra. And it's the energy center that's most connected with and governs all of our basic survival needs. Concerns about food, concerns about clothing, concerns about survival are governed by this most basic center. When we are having challenges in that area, putting your attention on at the base of the spine and enlivening it with the correct vibration helps to make that energy more vibrant, more powerful. It helps you to overcome those fears associated with that survival center. So everyone would just close their eyes. Put your attention at the base of your spine. The mantra for the first chakra is Lam, Lam. So everyone, let's just take a deep breath, and on your exhalation, just release Lam. The second energy center is in the reproductive area. It's associated with reproduction, with nourishment, with cleansing, with purification. It's lively when you are feeling romantically inclined towards someone, when you're feeling sexually oriented towards someone. It's the second chakra. The mantra for this is Vam, Vam. So putting your attention on your second energy center, take a deep breath on your inhalation and on your exhalation, Vam. The third energy center is in the solar plexus. It governs power. It governs the fulfillment of your intentions and your desires in the world. When you're having difficulties fulfilling those intentions or desires, there's a tendency to feel a cramping or a tightness in your gut. That's due to blockages in this third energy center. The mantra for this is Ram, Ram. So everyone, take a deep breath. The fourth energy center is centered in the heart, Anahata in Sanskrit, which means unstruck. It's that which connects us at that deep level of compassion. The mantra for the heart center is Yam, Yam. So again, with your attention on your heart, take a deep breath. Ya. Fifth energy center is located in the throat. It governs expression, how we can express ourselves to the world. When you're having difficulty feeling that you're being heard, emotionally or otherwise, there's often a sense of some constriction in your throat. Putting your attention here, activating the correct vibration, helps to relieve that constriction. The mantra for the throat chakra is hum, hum. Deep breath. Ha. Sixth energy center, which is localized between the eyes, it's considered the third eye between the eyebrows. It's responsible for insight, intuition, inner vision. The mantra for this is Sham, Sham. Deep breath. Sham. Finally, the seventh energy center, Sahasrara, the thousand-petal lotus, is located at the top of the head, at the crown of the head. And this is the universal mantra, Om. So with your attention on the crown chakra, deep breath. Very specifically and very therapeutically. If we see people that are having unexplained infertility or difficulties with pregnancies, we have them put their attention on the reproductive chakra, and several times a day we encourage them to just use their attention and intention and the correct mantra to bring energy flowing into that area. Someone's having ulcer pain, having a lot of tension in their stomach, we have them put their attention in their solar plexus. Use the correct mantra for that. If someone's grieving in their heart, having trouble getting over a loss, we have them put their attention on their heart chakra. If someone's having difficulty expressing themselves, having chronic neck pain, thyroid problems, we can often enliven that area by just attention, intention, and introducing the correct vibration. So they can be used very practically. And your clients and patients will love it. Spend 5 minutes, it'll have much more powerful effect and analyzing every event that led up to the most recent dramatic event in someone's life. Now, studies on mantra meditators have been filtering into Western medical literature since the 40s. Some really remarkable stories of scientists going to India and taking experienced yogis and putting them in airtight boxes and leaving them there for hours and having them come out and being completely normal and healthy, showing that they can slow their heart rate down to just a few beats per minute or literally stop their breathing for minutes at a time. So what did these studies show? They showed that with just a simple repetition of a vibration, a simple mantra like Om or Lam or Ram, that you can see dramatic changes in physiological functioning. Oxygen consumption dropped 15 to 20%. Which actually was deeper than that which had been described in people who go into deep sleep or in people who practice hypnotherapy. They found that the breathing rate slowed substantially, often down to 6 or 7 breaths per minute, but commonly at least several breaths per minute. It showed that the chemistry of the blood changed. Lactic acid, which is a measurement of a stress response, usually reflecting lack of oxygen, fell substantially. And skin resistance, which is another measurement of relaxation, rose substantially. So these various measurements on the physiology of meditation really were quite unique. Then a lot of information began pouring in on what happens to the EEG patterns of people who are meditating. At first, we noticed that shortly after people started meditating, they would generate continuous trains of alpha, cycles of brainwave activity between 8 and 12 cycles per second. And then it was shown that after a little while, people went into a period of theta rhythm. And theta is usually associated with drowsiness. But when people usually go through a drowsy state, they only stay there for a brief period of time, maybe a minute or so, and then they quickly move into deeper stages of sleep. But what we were seeing in people who were meditating was that they were staying in this theta state for 15, 20, 30 minutes at a time, just hovering on that borderline between wakefulness and sleeping state, and accessing those kind of dreamlike images that normally we only experience right before we wake up or right as we're falling asleep. This is what led to this description of the meditative state as a state of restful alertness. Restful because the body in many ways was at a deeper level of relaxation than we see even during sleep, but alert because the mind, the brain, was functioning in a different pattern. Then people became very interested in looking at what are the relationships of brainwaves from one part of the brain to the other. So people started measuring brainwave activity in various sites around the skull and found some interesting correlations that the farther someone got into a meditation practice, the more there was this measurement of coherence. That first, the left side of the brain and the right side of the brain began to line up in a very rhythmic pattern. Normally, there's a lot of disjunction, discordance. But during meditation, it seemed like there was a synchrony, a coherence that was generated during meditation. Then as the meditation progressed, there was actually a coherence between the back part of the brain and the front part of the brain in patterns that really had not been seen before. But yet there was this pattern of coherence in the brain, which is really quite interesting and quite phenomenal. What's so interesting is that if you read the Vedic literature, this is exactly the description of the fourth state of consciousness known as samadhi. So it has a number of benefits. It most importantly gets us in touch with that deepest aspect of ourself, beyond space and time. It allows us to quiet our mind, in many ways reset our system. And we talked about the fight or flight response. We have this built-in activation response, but we also have this built-in relaxation response, this built-in restful alertness response, so that after we've expended energy, we can very naturally bring our attention back to the center point, rejuvenate the system, and allow us to once again get in touch with our creativity. It's from this perspective of silence that we actually are the most successful. I'm sure everyone, I certainly have had the experience that you cram for an examination. You have a million facts stuffed into your brain. And you sit down, and the first question throws you for a loop. It wasn't something you studied. And immediately, my mind starts racing. Uh-oh, what if the rest of the test was like this? What if I don't pass this test? The mind starts getting noisier and noisier and noisier. And yet, all you need to do is bring the mind to a quiet place, and suddenly information emerges. Our minds work best from this platform of quietness. Meditation is really one of the most profound ways to achieve that state. And simultaneously, it creates this quietness in the body. Now, it's not complicated. Certainly, we encourage people to learn a mantra meditation technique because it brings the signal of attention to the most internal, subtle level that we can. But we can do it easily through other techniques. So let's go ahead and just to remind everyone, we'll go through a breathing awareness meditation technique. So let's do it together. Everyone just sitting comfortably. So when you're sitting comfortably, get in the habit of sitting with your back supported, your feet on the ground, your hands in some comfortable position, but not with your head supported. We're so conditioned that when we rest our head back on something to fall asleep that we can very quickly bypass that junction point date where we're accessing these deeper levels of our minds but maintaining awareness and maintaining alertness. Now let's just close our eyes. And I'd like you to notice that just by closing the eyes and bringing our attention inwards, doing nothing else, we feel some calmness, some relaxation. automatically the brain starts to quiet down. Alpha activity is generated in the visual part of the brain to begin with. Now notice that in the quietness, thoughts spontaneously arise in your awareness. You don't have to do anything to have a thought. It's the most effortless thing that we can do. You can't force your mind to stop having thoughts, because the field of pure potentiality is the place of least effort. You can't use effort to get there. So the only thing you can do when you have a lot of thoughts is let the thoughts come, keep your attention coming back to the breath or to your mantra, drift away, just bring it back again. So thoughts are just reflection of that release of stressful activity. Now in this quietness, very gently, shift your attention to your breath. It's just a slight shift of attention. And simply observe your breathing. Observe your inhalations and your exhalations. Your inhalations and your exhalations. Aren't you glad that somebody else is worrying about regulating your breath? And as you observe your breath, it may change. It may get slower and deeper. It may get faster or shallower. Sometimes it may even seem to pause for a time. Whatever happens with your breath, simply and innocently observe it. Don't try to alter it in any way. Don't resist any changes. Simply witness it. Observe it. And you'll find that at times your attention drifts away from your breath to some thoughts in the mind, or sensations in the body, or some sound in the environment. And whenever you realize that your attention has drifted off of your breathing, very effortlessly, very gently, very innocently, shift your attention back to your breath. So we'll continue like this for about 10 minutes. Okay, we'll begin.